Hello. 1, 2. Hi. This is the first of a bunch of episodes I'm releasing in one day. Because I'll either be on tour when you hear this, or about to go on tour, or have just been on tour, something like that, I'm definitely not going to have the time to watch all the movies that I need to make a proper episode. And as the regular listeners know, these episodes tend to be split into two parts, and they roll on for about 5 hours. So if you woke up this morning expecting to hear the first part of 1973, many apologies to you. That'll be happening on the 1st of September. And yes, it gets worse. I'll be on holiday in October, so that month I'll be doing the same thing. But then I will be back the following month, I promise. I just don't want to bring you lot that have been so good to me, so kind and like so faithful and telling your friends about the show and things like that. I don't want to bring you lot half-arse stabs at those big episodes. So I'm not going to do it. Instead, I've just taken a bunch of my favourite chats that I've already included in those long-winded episodes I just mentioned. I've pulled them out straight out of context. Anyone can now listen to these individually. I think there's going to be maybe 8 of them going up today. So have a look on the front cover. If you like it, click play. Many apologies again. Enjoy.
What an excellent day for an exhibition.
You know what the most frightening thing in the world is? It's fear.
Ever you do.
I first saw this one a few years ago. Even at my ancient age of 40, I still found this one quite startling, purely for the amount of devilry and all the naked women in this thing. Even after all I've watched, I still found it quite overwhelming. And yeah, still it didn't have that same effect as the devilry and the nakedness as my number one pick. That's coming. Holy Christ, that's going to be coming. But this one is just as delicious if you do love that sort of thing. Before we go in, I have to mention Dick Bush's stunning cinematography here. It captures that quintessential earthy and creepy Britishness at its very heart. And I think it's one of the reasons why this one is so huge to me. This is one of the big three of folk horror. And my number three for 1971, we have Piers Haggard's Blood on Satan's Claw.
When the grave of the devil is disturbed by the plough, the satanic essence of evil wreaks violent and revolting revenge.
But it weren't human, sir. They were a fur.
Then it was an animal's remains.
It were more like some fiend.
And the evil grows quickly, attacking first the youth of the village and making them the devil's children.
Ralph, look. Look.
Oh, God, I prayed I'd never see that again. That's what they call the devil's skin.
Doctor, witchcraft is dead and discredited. Are you bent on reviving forgotten horrors?
How do we know, sir, what is dead?
Blood on Satan's Claw.
A chill-filled festival of horror.
The accidental unearthing of Satan's earthly remains causes the children of a 17th century English village to slowly convert into a coven of devil worshippers. Now, the only other thing I know about Piers Haggard is he also directed Venom in 1981, and I'm always seeing that poster whenever I'm flicking through Letterboxd, so I'm excited to see it. He made that in 81, as I said, that's a decade after this one came out, but that's all the horror that I can find from him. And judging from the cover of Venom, I think it's a horror about Snake, but I'm yet to see it. It's going to be rubbish, but I'm going to love it, I know it, I know it, I know I am. Anyway, Blood on Satan's Claw. We are going to uncover, we are going to discover, we are going to chat with Mark Canali in a few moments all about Blood on Satan's Claw, right? Don't panic. But before we get there, I do want to mention this MVP that can be nobody else except Linda Hayden. She plays this schoolgirl. She's turned evil. She's a seductress. Her name is Angel Blake. That's the character she plays. Now, she was 17 when she starred in this, and she acts her pants off. Oh, that's an unfortunate term of phrase. She acts her pants off. But she, in the actual film, and literally acts her pants off many of the adults in this. See what I did? Didn't even realise. Many adults in this movie. I had a little sit down and I tried to think of one and I couldn't. I mean, I can't think of a better portrayal of occult evil like that's centered in one person in the whole plethion of 70s occult horror. She's just so utterly callous in her methods. And of course, she is oddly seductive, even with those crazy eyebrows that she got. And of course, that infectious patch of hairy skin that starts spreading throughout the village. And I cannot wait to watch more of her as I progress through the years when I'm doing this a year in horror podcast. She's got to be in so much more. I haven't looked. I really hope it's not the only performance that I catch of hers because she's really good in this. Now with this film, clearly I give it huge props. It is my number 3 pick from 1971 and I give this a hard recommend if you haven't seen it before. But right now, I'm going to insert my little chat that I have with my good bud, Mark Canale. Now he blew me away last time that we spoke. He did tons of research. He has an advanced knowledge on me about just about everything horror. It should really be his podcast, let's face it. We did, in the last episode, 2010's Confessions. And yeah, pretty much I could just sit back and listen to this guy talk. I was learning so much that I didn't catch the first time I saw it. So anyway, here he is. This is me and Mark Canale having a chinwag all about blood on Satan's Claw. Hello, Mark.
Hello, Paul.
I'm really glad you chose this film.
Yes, me too.
When I look at 71, I know nothing about it except the big hitters. And I was just like, what's left? And unfortunately, what's happened is 71 seems to be full of giallo. So much. Vampire flicks with many boobs and full frontage. I was not aware how pervy it was in 71.
Sexual revolution gone mad at that point, isn't it?
Yeah, it really is. It's like, oh, what can we do? Let's do it. A lot of the time, I feel like I'm watching porn. Soft porn, I grant you, but yeah. Moving not so far from that, we're going to talk about Blood on Satan's Claw.
Yeah.
Now, this always interested me, but I didn't find it until late. I was a massive Witchfinder General fan, but really for me, it was always Wicker Man. And this one was always, I'll watch it one day. And when I did, it sort of overtook Witchfinder for me because I find Witchfinder so bleak. I find it so horrible all the way through. It doesn't let up. Whereas the others...
Reminds you too much of your own existence, really, doesn't it?
Yeah. It's just permanent turmoil. But what is great about this one is it's ripe for the rewatch. I'm constantly missing things. It's full of lore that you never get on just one viewing, unless you've got a pen and paper with you, because there is so much going on. It's a beautiful thing to look at. When did you first come across it yourself?
Really similar to you, actually, in a way, because Wicker Man has been a favourite film of mine for decades, to be honest with you, since I probably first saw it when maybe late teens, something like that. Always loved it. Just always loved the whole feel of it. It wasn't really that, I mean, you know, if you think about the kind of folk horror genre type thing, that didn't even really exist that long ago. So, you know, it was just one of those really weird films that just kind of stood out, and you were like, you know, this Christopher Lee, like Hammer horror type thing, it's not like that. This isn't like some gothic castle kind of, you know, Dracula, Frankenstein, or a bit of a twist. This is some bizarre sort of thing. So yeah, The Wicker Man, always, yes. Witchfinder General, again, yes, I came to a bit later on, but I have to say, a bit different to you, that never really got to me that much. I liked it, it's a good film. And it's really harsh in some ways, But I also think it's got an awful lot of just kind of melodrama in it that doesn't really sit very well. And then when it boils down to it, there's no lore in it, really. There's no witchcrafty type stuff going on. It really is just about two con men. That's really all Witchfinder General is about. It's just about two psychotic con men who are just going around making money by getting villagers to kill each other. That's basically it, really. When you actually finish it, you kind of like go, oh, well, okay. So really, it was just about these two horrible guys. That's about it, really. It's like a serial killer film, really, where they don't really kill anyone themselves. They just kind of get everyone else to do it.
Yeah, definitely. Okay.
But yeah, so it was good, but I always felt a little bit let down with it because it was always so hyped up. But yeah, the blood on Satan's claw, and I like the at the beginning. It's the blood on Satan's claw. That, I have to admit, was more when I was sort of starting to look at the folk horror thing. And after Mark Gatiss's documentary, The History of Horror, I don't know if you've ever seen it, but he was the one that kind of popularized the term folk horror about 10 years ago. And obviously since then, it's kind of blown up and just been one of those sort of crazy things, even though we might discuss this a little bit later on. I'm not entirely sure what the genre actually is, what it really, how do you define a folk horror film? But we can talk about that later on because that will sort of come into that. Yes, yeah, so it was more at that sort of point in time. It was like, oh, right, this other one's sitting there, The Blood and Satan's Claw. I've heard of it, never seen it. Gave it a watch, you know, just, well, it's one of the unholy trilogy, right? It's going to be up there. And yeah, I personally was knocked out. Personally, I was watching it with, not so much. I think because some of the aspects of, you know, what was actually, you know, portrayed in the film. But I was knocked out by the, just the authenticity of it in many ways.
I totally agree. Like you said, that's when I discovered, with that documentary, is when I discovered that there was this thing. It wasn't just The Wicker Man. It wasn't just that. And my first step was Witchfinder General. And I was quite content with it. And going forward, I would always have a name for these films that I thought might just be witchy or English folk tales sort of.
Yeah, yeah.
But yeah, you're quite right. Nailing that term, it is tricky to pin down what it actually is, but you just know by saying it what the feel, what the tone is.
Yeah, exactly.
I don't know if you want to go into it now. What is folk horror?
Yeah, a very long, very boring one, probably. Yeah.
But I people tell me when I'm chatting with them on the social networkers that it's all to do with soil. It's all to do with English.
I was just going to say that. Yeah, it's about the dirt. It's about the ground beneath you, isn't it? Yeah. I mean, I think with this film in particular as well, with The Blood and Satan's Claw, this film is all about mud. It's all about soil. It's all about the tilled earth, the furrows. You know, it's all set around that. The opening is all about that. Everything feels muddy. Everything feels a bit, you know, grimy, but not in a city way, not in an oily way, in a kind of just a muddy, detritus-y kind of way, doesn't it? Everything feels like that. Everything's sort of stained. Everyone's got muddy feet. Everyone's wandering about in sort of muddy puddles of stuff, you know?
Yeah, I agree. Like, just from the opening scene, you're straight in the mud.
Yeah.
And that's part of what's so glorious about this. Just from that description, you think, ugh, it's going to be sort of small and grimy. And that's not what you're presented with at all. You're presented with vast landscapes, and when you're enclosed, when you're in a house, or when you're in a church or whatever it may be, it feels authentic. It feels so English, so of what we know here.
Yes, or in a way, not even just what we know, because I think one of the important things about this idea of it being in the ground and in the soil and the dirt, it's kind of what is it that's actually in the soil? What is it that's in the dirt? What is it? What is it that we're actually scared of here? What is it that's actually scaring us? Yeah, there's the tropes that we get scared of. Of course we are. Being killed, being, you know, by murdered by someone is of course going to be scary, the idea of people under threat. But with these films, what is that extra thing that we're actually scared of? And I find it a really interesting question, because it's this like, what, witchcraft? I don't know, sort of cursing. And you start thinking, well, no, maybe it's not really that. Look at Witchfinder General. It doesn't really have any of that. It's really about the history of us in a way, even if, you know, I mean, I'm mainly Scots and Irish, so I'm slightly different from that kind of thing, but you still feel it by living in this country. It's that sort of connection that the land has and its history to a kind of, how would you put it? Like a nastiness, like this sort of, historically, this idea of our history of normal people doing terrible things, be it in the sake of religion or be it in the sake of anything, of bringing a harvest, of doing anything. It's that idea that there's a connection, or at least a feel of, is it still in the ground? Is it still there? Is it part of who you are by living here? Is it part of, you know, when you look out there, is it out there? Is it still out there? Could it still happen again, just because you feel that it's part of the DNA of the people that live here, or the country, the land?
It's fascinating, isn't it? Like the ground, the dirt, the grass literally is witness to history, to blood, to death, to life, to birth, to everything. From life to when it goes rotten, which is what you see a lot of in here. And what really struck me here, because we're dealing with 71, is, as I said at the beginning, there's a lot of giallo, but when it's not dealing with those Italian flicks that I just cannot get with yet, I will. It's pretty still rooted in a lot of what's gone before. I find watching this film, there's this West Country accent now and again that you'll straight away.
Everyone's kind of
things like that. Just feel make it the whole thing feel really grounded and real. Whereas I'm looking at a floating vampire, and as much as I love that, that isn't what you're getting here. This feels really grounded.
Yeah. This is one of the interesting things about this film in particular as well, because although the studio, Tygon, was based in Pinewood, I think, this is a film, one of their films, that they shot mainly on location, which is pretty unusual for a low-budget film like that. It normally was just shot in the studio where the production would normally be, you know, and just cheap and just knock it out, build your sets and all that sort of thing. They actually went on location. It was filmed around about different places, but one of the main places, the ruined churchyard that where the real nastiness takes place in and stuff like that, and quite a few of the actual houses that you'll see, the kind of villagers' houses and stuff, which are authentic, but they're not sets. They are actually filmed inside these houses. They were authentically like that. I'm sure obviously the insides were sort of done up to look like that. I don't think people were still living in like 16th century or whatever it was meant to be. But so it was filmed in Oxfordshire, and a place called Bix in Oxfordshire. It's actually not far from Henley. And this, the ruined church actually is in the middle of just nowhere. This church is just sitting, just surrounded by trees and fields. And what's interesting about that is it did used to be the village church of a little place, and I can't remember what the name of the village was, Bix something. But the village is no longer there because it was essentially wiped out because of plague. So the church itself is a destroyed, you know, is a ruin essentially because of plague from the Middle Ages. Essentially, the population just dwindled and went off, and it died. The village died and the church died because of that, which I thought was quite an interesting thing of the feel of where they were filming it. Particularly that churchyard actually has a kind of, would have a feel as well, that sense of history and that sense of, you know, death and so on, and the dead church. But yes, I mean, in terms of the authenticity, it's, you know, it's filmed almost entirely in location in places, and that's unusual. And sometimes you don't really notice it, but you can feel it a lot of the time. You don't realize it the first time you see it.
Is that church still there?
Yeah. You can look it up. I think Sight and Sound magazine did a couple of years ago, went there, and a guy went there and took some photos and stuff just to soak it in, so to speak. Apparently it looks a bit different now. The woods have been cleared up a bit, I think, around it.
Right.
It's not quite as run down, I think, because it was collapsing. So I think the kind of English Heritage or something had to go in or something, and, you know, the local council or something just had to get some work done on it or something like that. But it is still there, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I've Google mapped before a similar thing, whereas there is a lot of this going on, like you say, because of the plague. The villages, villagers have moved. Yeah. Their cheaper buildings have all gone, by the way. And what's left is just random church throughout the English countryside.
Yeah, just lost. Yeah, exactly. It's that's amazing. And the woodlands and stuff like that, it's all authentic. And you can feel that. You can feel, you know, when they go out there, I love some of the woodland scenes in the film. Because you do, they didn't film it in the middle of summer. They obviously filmed it in kind of, I presume, winter or maybe early spring. I think it was maybe early spring. I think it was April or something they filmed it in. So, you know, the trees are kind of bare. There's nothing really, there's no lush greenery. Yes, there's greenery because it's sort of starting to come through, but there's certain bits of it where it's just the bit with the girl, what's her name? Margaret, the girl who's sort of they find, who gets thrown in the lake, whether to see whether she's a witch or not, kind of thing. She that bit where she's getting chased through the forest and the guy's chopping the tree down, it's just a guy in the middle of a forest just chopping this little birch tree down or something like that, and it's an amazing, I think it's an amazing shot and scene because it's so bleak looking. And you just, it's just, there's no greenery. It's just this guy in the wet, damp earth chopping a tree down. And here comes a young girl getting chased and thrown in a lake just to see if she's a witch. And it's just, that's really lovely, that kind of thing.
It's a total gift to the cinematographer to do that. Oh, yeah. Oh, my goodness. What is his name? I forget.
Wow. What a segue. Brilliant. You're a pro. That was Mr. Richard Bush, otherwise known as Dick Bush. And I tell you what, you know, let's break the fourth wall here. We messaged each other about this, just as like, you know, wow, this, what a name this guy's got. So I look him up, of course.
Of course.
Because I think, what's this guy done? This dude's awesome. And it's actually sort of makes reference a bit to you talking about the Devils, because he did a lot of work with Ken Russell. He was a cinematographer in Tommy. For example, he did the cinematography in Tommy. He did Lair of the White Worm. I think, what was the one that he did? Oh, about the composer. I've forgotten. Marla. He did the photography, cinematography for that. Yeah, he also did another one of my favorite films as well. And this one's completely bonkers because it's like, where did this guy doing all these little British films suddenly work with William Friedkin? And he did Sorcerer with Roy Scheider. I don't know if you've seen Sorcerer. So they put it on your list, but that, you know, even just as a kind of casual take a break from horror, even though, to be honest with you, it's probably more tense than most of the horror films you'll actually see. But yeah, it's just as an out, this dude's done some proper work. So, you know, that's two mugs laughing at his name, but that guy's, you know, legit, to be fair. But yeah, I think he did a great job here in Satan's Claw. I really think he does.
It's one of those names that you see it, you take a photo, you have a giggle. I had to stop it and pause it and show Claire. I had no choice.
We're so clever, aren't we? We're very clever, man.
I want to talk about a scene that gets me every time. I can't say I've watched this hundreds of times. I've watched it four now. But I don't look forward to this scene. It pushes buttons. It triggers me. And I'm talking about Kathy.
Yes, yeah. Poor Kathy.
It is heartbreaking. And I wrote here in my notes, it's heartbreaking and cruel. There seems no way out for her. And once you've watched it once and then you watch it again, every time you see her, it crushes you.
Yeah, and I think it's the worst second time around. Not in terms of worse, I mean, it's more, it feels darker. I think the more you see it, because, you know, you're then more aware of what's going to happen as well, and you sort of, you have that real feel of it building up to this moment. Once you've seen it once, you kind of, it does feel in, yeah, that there is that. It's one of those sort of scenes that you could be critical about, certainly looking at it in a modern perspective. And it's, as I said, the person I was watching it with, my other half, it ruined the film essentially for them, because she felt it was just too much. It was just, it felt sort of just over the top, just exploitation, basically.
Sure.
Which, and I think the reason why that has an effect in this film is because the film, I don't think, deserves that in a way. I have no problem with exploitation filmmaking, and particularly contextually at the time, that's, you know, that if you're going to watch movies in a way, if you know, what you're going to watch, you're never going to watch anything after, you know, before 2010, if you're not going to take some sort of context of when things were made and what was going on in the culture, and, you know, good or bad or whatever, okay.
Of course. Yeah, I agree.
So the reason I think I have a bit of a problem with it is I just don't think the film deserves it. It seems too good a film. And it's led me to kind of look into why. Why does this film have that feel to it? Because there's a couple of other scenes in it that have that exploitation-y feel to it as well. If we look at the scene near the end, just before the end, where there's like a kind of satanic dance thing going on just before the sort of witch hunters all come in and sort of save the day. So there's this sort of dance coming on. And then, of course, you know, there's a guy about to chop his leg off to, you know, sort of with the hair growing on the leg, and he's just getting his knife ready to chop it off. And what happens, of course, here comes the lady and it all comes out, you know, and you get a little bit of boogieing. And you just kind of like, so hold on a minute. He gets taken there to be sacrificed. He gets what, like a lap dance? A girl goes there to get, she gets raped. You're like, hold on a minute. There's like some, there's a bit of a gender imbalance going on here, isn't there?
100%. Yeah. And I feel like it is a product of that time. The harsh thing is it's children portraying this violence against a child. It's really harsh to watch. It's interesting that you mentioned that that film doesn't deserve it, because it feels like not a lot of consideration went into it. It's like, well, that's in the script. We're going to go there. That's what we're going to do.
Well, I disagree that it was in the script. Well, I mean, it would have been in the script, but there's a reason for it. And this is where I'm saying about the context. Okay. Now, I don't know if you know about Tygon Productions, the company that made it.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Obviously, at this period of time, there were essentially three big horror studios in the UK making sort of these sorts of movies. And you know Hammer, obviously. And they'd been going since, what, the sort of mid-50s. They were on a proper decline at this point in time. You know, their kind of brand of gothic horror with these sort of very sort of proper actors. It really wasn't interesting, the kids of late 60s. You know, the teenagers, the early 20s, the people who are your customer, if you're making horror film, they weren't interested in that anymore. So Hammer was losing its way. It was trying to get a little bit more groovy. If you've seen some of their films, you know exactly what I was kind of like going to get to. It's a little bit embarrassingly kind of, oh, right, okay. But it wasn't really working, and they were going downhill quite badly. Then you had Amicus. Of course, you had Amicus Productions, and they'd started in the mid to early 60s, and they kind of went more with a kind of fun angle. They were doing this kind of portmanteau kind of horror, getting kind of stars in that were more sort of younger and stuff like that, and people that were in big, Roddy McDowell's. I mean, who can forget Roddy McDowell's performance in The House of Drip Blood as the vampire guy? You know, it's like, you know, these guys, and he'd just been in, I would have thought he was, you know, Planet of the Apes. He was a kind of relatively big star kind of thing at the time. But, you know, David Warner, people like this, who were kind of these younger sort of actors, and they kind of had them in. There wasn't really that much exploitation going on. It was more a kind of fun sort of thing, a night of the movies, Friday night movie kind of thing. That was, it was meant to be, but kind of silly. You look at them now and you feel they're a bit kind of daft. Then you had Tygon. Now, Tygon was founded by a guy called Tony Tenser, who is also the executive producer of Blood and Satan's Claw, because of Tygon Productions. Now, you look up Tony Tenser, and his background from the very early sort of 60s was essentially in, well, let's put it this way, some of his early productions were Naked as Nature Intended, My Bare Lady, London in the Raw. You know, this was a guy who basically was on the exploitation bandwagon from word go. You know, this guy had essentially, this is what he did from right until the sort of late 60s. He just did these kind of nudie sort of Soho flicks, you know, that just a bit grimy and a bit kind of, you know, whatever. Yeah,
I can't imagine they stand up too well. I love the posters, but I just know what's going to be involved.
Oh, yeah. Oh, just a bit. Okay, right. So, but anyway, he then makes Repulsion with Roman Polanski. It's pretty much out of the blue. Now, I presume Roman Polanski came over to do this. That was his first film in London, I think, after sort of Polish sort of films, and he just came over and did that. So I'm assuming Tony Tenser and Tygon kind of sort of went, all right, okay, yeah, we'll help you make this film. And you get Repulsion, which is pretty amazing, you know. And there's a slight element of sort of exploitation in it, but not a lot. It's a pretty, you know, really well-made film. But what then happens is he makes Witchfinder General after that, because that's a Tygon production as well. And he makes a couple of other movies. Now, you can start seeing this sort of trend. This guy's no mug, and he's getting these guys in to make sort of these quite good movies. What he's doing is he's getting directors in that are no mugs. These are kind of classically trained guys, or these are guys that have got a reputation. These are not just your sort of two-bit directors that have worked a bit on telly and then wouldn't mind making a film. And, you know, what do you want in it? How many boobs? All right, over there. Right, okay, yeah, I'll film that. Yeah. This just wasn't like that. These guys were educated. They'd worked in the theatre. And he was giving them money to make the film. My guess is with a proviso. Now, my guess is his attitude was, yeah, but, you know, you're making a horror film, so I want 3 minutes of boobs. I want this. Yeah, I want blood. So I want plenty of red blood. I want loads of all this guts and stuff, because that's what the kids want, right? I want to do that. The rest of it, you can do what you want. You know, I don't mind if you want to make some arty kind of whatever, as long as you've got these things. And you look at Blood on Satan's Claw, which is a bit later on, 71, but made in 1970. But you can sense, I think, that's what's going on with the film. That's why I feel it's out of place. That's why I feel the film doesn't deserve it, because I think this is Tony Tenser in the background going, where's the tits? I'm sorry, we need some more. You know, and the other kind of slightly uncomfortable bit is Linda Hayden, who's amazing in this film as Angel Blake. She is astonishing in this film. Now, there's the scene in the schoolhouse, church, whatever you want to call it, mm-hmm. with Reverend Fallowfield. What a great name that is. Reverend Fallowfield, sorry. And, of course, if there's a bit of exploitation, any kind of, you know, okay, they all come off. Well, here we go, full frontal type thing. She was 17 when they filmed that. And it's, you know, when you know that kind of thing, you're like, sort of like, oh, come on, son. You know, what's going on? You know, she's barely
found
out of school.
Out in the extras, and it made me look at the whole piece differently. I think her performance, she's a rock star in this. Like,
absolutely.
Unbelievable performance. Yeah. I could not, the first thing I thought was there was no way that she's acting the pants off all these
Patrick Weimark.
Massive catalogues behind them.
Exactly.
Like, how are you doing this? You're so young. And then it struck me, oh, that scene. Wow.
Oops.
Exactly. Can you imagine today? Can you imagine that happening?
Well, it would be illegal. You couldn't. But at the same time, it's like there is an element of kind of, it just shows you it was a bit seedy. These guys, you know, these guys were a bit seedy. Now, Piers Haggard, the director, this guy came from theatre and stuff like this. He came from a very theatrical background. This way, he wasn't an established film director, probably why he took the gig, kind of to sort of do a few more sort of film type things. But this wasn't the sort of thing this guy would have been doing. And if you listen to the interview in History of Horror, he says himself, you know, he's a young man and he got carried away and he wouldn't have done this now. I reckon even at the time he probably felt uncomfortable about it. I think he's just sort of like covering that up when he was sort of saying that. I think he was kind of pushed into it to some degree, and kind of maybe as a younger guy sort of thought, all right, whatever, you know, that's fine, we'll just do it. But he says he kind of regretted making it as quite as nasty as it was, in terms of the rape scene and so on. As I say, these guys that he got to make these films, these were, you know, the writer Robert Wynne Simmons. This is a guy that came from did English Lit at Cambridge, and his only other credit, young guy, only other credit before this film, it was a film about William Blake, about how William Blake's, I think it's Dreams of Albion, I think it's called. And it's about some of William Blake's prophetic poems and writings and sort of relating them to modern existence and seeing how they come true, sort of the idea of that. It's a kind of art house movie, short film. But obviously this guy comes from a literary background. This guy's writing something. So you kind of do a bit of digging in this sort of, and you think, okay, well, hold on a second. She's called Angel Blake. Well, that's no, like, that's clearly no accident, is it? So why Angel, right? You know, the names here are all, they all mean something, all these characters. So you look up and William Blake wrote a poem called The Angel. It's one of his famous poems.
You sleuth.
Exactly. Well, you know, Google is your friend, as always, in these things, you know. Just type in Angel and Blake. That's all you have to do. First thing that pops up, pretty much, apart from Linda Hayden's character, yeah, is the poem. in Songs of Innocence and Experience. Yeah, you know, as I say, I'm not going to chase away all of your listeners by literally sitting and reading out a William Blake poem in Nimbus Letters. Suffice to say, it's not a long poem. It's quite short. It's only like four verses. But it's essentially, in a way, it's this film. It's a bit William Blakey as well. It's a bit all over Blakey, so I'm on the buses. It's a bit Blakey.
It's a bit Blakey.
But it's about the loss of innocence. That's the point. He dreams that he is a maiden queen that's guarded by an angel, that has a guardian angel that protects them. But what happens is they don't want the guardian angel anymore because it suppresses them. So they get rid of the angel. And of course, all hell breaks loose. The queen is what she describes as, you know, I dried my tears and armed my fears with 10,000 shields and spears. So goes nuts, goes crazy, you know, loses her innocence. And of course, the angel comes back again, but it's too late because the innocent girl is gone. And it's now an experienced woman who has sort of cynicism and all the rest of it. So you suddenly, you read that and you like think, okay, this film's about that, isn't it? This film is obviously about the loss of innocence. There's no question about that. And it's the children being the ones that commit the crimes, that commit these terrible things. And the adults are sort of, what's going on? You know, they're the ones that are almost lost and sort of don't really understand what's going on, right? So, yeah, so it's this, and you start thinking, okay, Kathy, her surname is Vespers. Well, the Vespers are the prayers that are said on evenings. They're the evening prayers in the Catholic Church, for example. Patrick Weimark plays a character, but his only name is the Judge. So you think, well, in William Blake's stuff, who's the judge? Who judges Adam in the Blake painting? It was God, right? So Patrick Weimark, is he playing God? God goes away. He leaves. Or is he the angel? He goes away. He leaves, doesn't he? And when he leaves, all hell breaks loose. Rape, murder. Whenever he comes back and redeems everyone, you know, and then sort of saves everyone merely by, you know, his presence almost. He comes back with this man of knowledge as much as anything. Comes back, so God, the angel, who knows? They don't know this sort of idea of it. The Reverend Fallowfield, as I say, great name. That's also an interesting one because Fallowfield. So the man of God has a surname that suggests what an empty dead field, no growth, you know, this idea of the land and sort of, you know, where we get this sort of idea of harvest and so on. But you know, the Reverend Fallowfield, he's not, you know, he symbolizes something that's not, that's dead, that doesn't have that, that's dried up and gone. And of course she comes to try and seduce him and there's nothing, there's I mean, suddenly you realize these guys writing this and making this film really has, as you said, has proper layers in it. That's, you know, literary layers and real symbolical, you know, layers and stuff that's going on. And this is about, actually looking into this and like watching it a few times, it's really made me appreciate it. If you're going to define a folk horror film, this is probably a better one than The Wicker Man.
Easy.
You know, this is because it's probably more about the themes that you would describe folk horror to be. You know,
it's so far from a hack job.
Oh, totally.
That's the thing. There is something just from the very first scene, from the way it's shot, especially the ground level shots as well. Incredible.
Yes.
Like, you don't see that amongst a film of that time. I'm so fascinated with what you've just said. So interesting. Because you know there is way more going on than those exploitative scenes.
Yeah, of course it is. And, you know, the folk horror theme of sort of the idea that, is it this sort of pagan, sort of the fear of this sort of pagan thing, this sort of fear of the barbarity. And then you've got the Christianity, the idea of the Christianity saving things. It was saving Britain in a way from its pagan roots, from its barbaric pagan roots. And this, you know, that Blake had this kind of sort of thing, obviously, where he was obsessed with this. And he saw the Industrial Revolution as a similar idea as well. That's why he was kind of did a lot of writing about that. Yeah, this film really does talk about some really heavy historical kind of concepts as well.
Oh, Mark, thank you so much.
No worries.
Oh, hope you enjoyed that chat with Mark and myself. But before we go to number two, let's just talk a little bit about this soundtrack. The creator of this soundtrack, Mark Wilkinson, was born in Paris, but is known as an Australian. I, myself, am also known as Australian, born in Frankston, raised in Frankston, immigrated to England when I was 9. But enough about me, let's talk about Mr. Mark Wilkinson, because he was 49 years old when he composed this. These facts just keep coming out, I hope you're taking note. Now, even though he composed 20 movie scores between the dates of 1968 and 1990, Blood on Satan's Claw was the only horror one. Although, I would say that if you've ever watched Hammer House of Horror, that TV series, then he did score a really cool episode called Visitor from the Grave. Now, this lack of experience in the horror genre, that in no way disqualifies him from producing a masterful work. This score is as mischievous and playful just as it is horror-fueled, and it rarely clings to any horror tropes. And it rings true because you've got this cast of kids and teenagers that are always mischievous and playful throughout the film, so it really works as this evil picks through these kids one by one. And as you heard, there are as many low-pounding stabs as there are high-pitched terror screeches. It's a really good score, and you can stream it. It is on Spotify. That's where I listen to it on. So definitely give it a go. It really works when you take it out of the context, and it really works when you put it in with the film. So where can you find Blood on Satan's Claw? Well, you can stream it for free. It's always on YouTube. But if you've got a Shudder subscription, you can also see it there. Or you can buy one of the many special editions of this one. It's not gone out of print like some of those others I've spoken about. This is everywhere. And if you're like me and you want to dig deeper, you want to go further, watch this film again and get more information in a more in-depth way, then go to these following podcasts. So we're going to kick off, of course, with Evolution of Horrors, Killer Double Bill of Witchfinder General and Satan's Claw. That came out in June 2018. Also in 2018, find Sleazoid's podcast that matches up Satan's Claw with Captain Kronos, if memory serves. I didn't write it down, but I did listen to it the other day. I think I'm right. I don't know. Okay, so just make notes. Listen, bring yourself some joy. Bring joy into your miserable life, just like I did with mine. Blood on Satan's Claw. Onwards, upwards.
Do you know what the most frightening thing in the world is? It's fear.
Every you do.